we gave Times employees a preview of crossplay from New York Times Games. And here's what they had to say.
I can finally play with other people.
I'm pretty competitive. It's fun to beat friends and coworkers.
I have a J for 10 points.
I'm guessing Tanga is not a word. Let's see. Tanga is a word. Oh.
As an English as a second language speaker, I like to learn new words.
New York Times Games subscribers get full access to crossplay, our first two-player word game. Subscribe now for a special offer on all of our games.
Toes out on a rainy day.
Oh, yeah. On a rainy day, you know?
That's your choice.
That definitely is your choice.
Y'all have any more of this iced coffee like this?
How do you like it?
It's like iced latte almond milk or regular milk? Or
any milk. Regardless, I'm going to be gassy.
Wow, okay.
So whatever.
And we're going to be locked
we
in
can
a
do
room.
Regular milk.
You want to be the first podcast guest to fart on mic?
I'm weak.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your Churchill Downs field trip of weekly cultural review. I'm John Caramonica, and I'm the critic.
I am Joe Coscarelli, and I'm the reporter.
And I am Drew Desbordes, a.k.a. Drewski.
And I'm on?
And I'm on Popcast.
That's right.
Drewski. They forced me to say that.
That's true.
I didn't want to say it, but...
It's contractual.
I had to contractual
Look,
you, stuff.
It's not like you've never said it. It's not like you've never said a,
no,
like never
said a
slogan.
I'm a fan.
Here's the thing.
I just didn't want to have to say it.
We
man.
Will now let your family members
good,
go.
Man.
We'll let
I'm
your family
tripping.
Members
I
go
ain't
now.
Tripping. I ain't tripping, man. It is what it is.
Drewski is here. Big day on Popcast. We have a tremendous amount of things to talk about. Joe, where do we know Drewski from? Where don't we know Drewski from?
I see Drewski every time I turn on my television from T-Mobile to Buffalo Wild Wings.
Oh.
One of the great corporate pitchmen of our time.
He's got his YouTube series. We're talking Could Have Been Records audition series, quasi-American Idol.
That was good, man.
We're talking about Could Have Been Love, now in its second season.
These women want one thing and one thing only. Money.
One part The Bachelor, 20 parts Flavor of Love.
But way more chaotic. Maybe you know Drewski skits about greedy pastors.
The white guy hanging out in the black neighborhood.
A NASCAR fan in full white makeup. He's popped up in music videos with Drake and Lil Durk, Jack Harlow and Drake, Drake and Lil Yachty.
But today, you're seeing him on Popcast. We got a lot that we're about to talk about. Drewski, welcome to the couch.
No, thank y'all for having me, man.
No, this is exciting. We're extremely pumped to have you.
No, thank you.
We're going to dive right in. Obviously, we are in the middle of season two of Could Have Been Love. Which we'd love to talk to you about. Human resources told us we couldn't, unfortunately.
Could Have Been Love season two.
Yeah. So we're just going to go right past that into the next subject, if that's okay.
Yeah. This is what else.
No. Talk to us a little bit about the difference between what you're referencing, because we all know what you're referencing. We grew up, obviously, on Flavor of Love and all those shows, as did you.
Yes.
Tell me about the difference between referencing the subject matter and creating something novel on top of it. How do you see the distinction between the two?
I think, honestly, I wanted to create something that was both entertaining while playing into the whole female fan base of what majority of all these girls are watching right now, which is like Love Island or, you know, I wanted to do something like that in my world, you know, and I think anybody who watches Drewski, if you watch any of the auditions or anything, Could Have Been Records from... 6-7 years ago when I used to do it on Instagram Live, I think you know like what that world looks like. And I think I wanted to bring that into the female fan base side of things, which is also definitely derived from, Flavor of Love with Flavor Flav. So
a little Bad Girls Club.
Yeah, a little bit of Bad Girls Club. Well, a lot of Bad Girls Club.
A lot of Bad Girls Club.
Almost like a little bit of the Jersey Shore vibe when they call on the phone and stuff. So it's a piece of everything I grew up watching in one show. And that's why I love it, yeah.
When you watched those shows as a younger person, especially as someone who was interested in comedy, did you see those shows as reality television or did you see them as comedy shows that happen to have real people?
I think it's definitely comedy shows. I would love the episodes where it's like chaos going on, but just the right amount of entertainment because, you know, some of those love shows that are like, you know, going on season 20, like The Bachelor, it's like I never really felt the entertainment side of it, because it was more so about real
too
love.
Earnest.
It was too
earnest
into the dating stuff and like the deep talk, the 20-minute thing of them talking at the dinner table.
And saying nothing.
Yeah, there's nothing being said. So I didn't like that stuff, but I did like Flavor of Love where he's giving out nicknames, or like Jersey Shore where they have this crazy thing going on where they go to the club and they come back and the chaos from the club is brought back to the house. Right. So it's like we do all that in every episode of our show as well. So I wanted to find something that would make our world feel like that. And yeah, we definitely... There's a lot of therapists in the house. And while
like actual therapy? Like,
no.
Oh, you never know.
I've been playing therapists on
the
show.
Well, sure. Yeah. Who amongst us, really?
Yeah.
It's free therapy for everyone involved.
Oh, for sure.
I'm interested in the way you've always woven comedy and fiction with documentary. You use a lot of real people.
For sure.
Blur the line between what's real, what's not real. Sure, for me, it's like in dialogue with Nathan Fielder, what he's doing, Safdie Brothers, you know, John Wilson, these sort of...
Also, just met Safdie Brothers.
Yeah. bet.
Just met them yesterday. I had a meeting with them,
Put them on the screen. You know,
we'll talk. Like, we'll talk. But that's, you know... We'll
I know you're heading in that direction.
Yeah, we are.
But the way you play with this version of reality warped through... decades of people knowing the jargon and the grammar of reality television. One thing that happens on reality TV, whether it's The Bachelor or The Real World, even long before that, is people start to know what it is they're showing up for. Like, did you find that now in the auditions and the Could Have Been Record stuff, or in season two of Could Have Been Love? Like, people now know what Drewski shows look like. Does that change how you have to approach them if they come with a better understanding of what you want from them?
And I think I've been really good at being able to, you know, I'm one of those people. I read body language. I'm very good at focusing on people. That's why my skits and like things, whenever I'm replicating another person or doing certain stuff, I'm very good at paying attention to who is in it, who's not. So when we do have these things where it's like maybe somebody comes and they're trying to be goofy or funny, we kind of don't involve them in the show. We go through pre-auditions and stuff with my team that are able to make sure it's not like a fake goofy situation. Like, if you're not here to actually, you know, fall in love with Drewski, or if you're not here to actually pursue this competition in a serious way, it's almost like we remove that
person. You filter out the people who are obvious.
Yeah, because, you know, it's not fun for the viewers either if the people aren't in it and, like, if it's not real. Yeah, it's a great recipe for good comedy. But I think majority of the stuff that we do is come out in a great way. And none of my comedy comes from, like, a punching down or a bullying type scenario. So anytime we do Could Have Been Records and we're, like, kicking people out constantly and it's, like, constant kick out, it never... I feel like we always have a good connection with the person after, or, like, when we went to Mexico or we went to Africa and did the auditions, we gave out money to each person that came, like, thank you for coming and being a part of this. And it's, like... sometimes we will show some of that stuff, sometimes we won't. But, you know, depending on where we're at, I think it is one of those things that we pride ourselves on doing business the right way, you know? Yeah.
But it's interesting to pick up on what Joe is saying. There is this sense that people know how I'm going to generate a viral Drewski moment. Like, they're coming in. Like, you're playing off them, but they're playing off you.
Yeah.
But, like, what's an example of something that could get someone preemptively cut? Because if I look at the people on season two, I'm like, these are the people that maybe I would cut.
For the auditions, the ones that you would say, like, are not going to make the final cut would be the ones that are coming in there, like, trying to be full-blown goofy or trying to be, like, oh, I'm going to be, you know.
Doing a bit.
Yeah, I'm going to do a bit.
Hey, I'm a big Luigi fan, man.
And you big getting your fucking ass out of here. Instead of doing what you naturally would come in and do. And I respect some of the comedians. Like, we let the comedians come in there and do their thing as well. But I think it's like some people will come in like a doctor outfit and like, oh, I'm coming in here to take your temperature. It's just weird shit.
They're
like,
trying too hard.
And it'll be like, we're not even going to put that in the edit. Right. It's just, I think the tryhards, like you just said, are the ones that usually don't make the edit, you know?
I think you have a real gift for what I would describe as instinctual anthropology.
For sure.
Like, and you talk about it in terms of reading body language.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk about yourself as a teenager learning to navigate the world and using that skill. Like, how did you hone that skill when you're 14, 15, 16, leading up to using it in comedy?
No, I think that's a great question. I think mainly... I come from the world of being in different avenues of life. So it's like I grew up in a suburb of around Mexican, Black, Indian, White, Hispanic, anything you could think of. And I have friends of all these races. So I think I always was a very visual learner on like trying to like figure out, oh, why is this person like this? Why is that person like that?
Mannerisms.
Or, yeah, mannerisms or just being around certain friends and then seeing the difference of being around my Indian friend and then being around my white friend or take note in my mind. It's not nothing that I would like study, but like I think that's my like view of comedy and why I think it has been so broad in the fan base, because I think we are able to connect with each and every person that understands. And people say it all the time, like, oh my God, you literally do skits on everything. It's not just one avenue of what it is or being funny in this area.
There's something universal about it, what you're doing, but there's also something super hyper-specific, like very Atlanta, very
for
Georgia,
sure.
very Black Southern, but with
a twist conversant
Indians enclaves and
for sure,
Mexican enclaves and white enclaves.
Sure.
Like this, these archetypes you're hitting on, you know, I think of something like the white guy in the hood.
I grew up on that side.
On that side, yeah.
But I was raised by these folks.
That's like real Atlanta stuff, right? Like shout out to white boy Derek. You know, like we know those guys.
And in the suburbs, you grow up with a lot of those white boys that are acting like a hood black dude. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's hard not to pick up on that type of stuff. And I think some of the best comedians that I even look up to are very good at paying attention to that type of like the stuff you know in the back of your mind, but you're like, oh shit, like how did that become a thing? Like you're thinking of
you
put a name to something that everybody realizes and knows.
And is it satisfying to you to be able to take those slices of your culture where you grew up and bring them to like an international audience?
Sure.
Like like be like, oh my God, I'm doing this thing that's so
for
Gwinnett. It's echoing
about Gwinnett,
on
man?
This low. I wrote a book about Atlanta.
It's right there. We'll give it to you on the way out.
I definitely want to see that. But what do y'all know about that? What made y'all do that?
I spent a lot of time there.
For real?
John and I have been covering.
Should we talk about Magic City? Are we talking about Blue Flame?
We talk about
strip clubs. We don't got to.
We'll talk about.
No, I just was curious.
It's not even 1 p.m.
No, but what made y'all do a book on that?
So John and I both been music writers, reporters for a long time. You know, John
started for Double XL. I was a music editor at Vibe before I was at the Times.
That has big influence.
When I
big
came
influence.
To the Times, 2014, 2015, it was this sort of renaissance of Atlanta rap music. And a lot of stuff I was covering in my job as the music reporter was down there. It was Rise of Migos, Ciotti.
That was
you know,
big
my
for
book
me.
Is like I followed Lil Baby throughout his whole first couple years.
Yeah.
I did his first ever interview. You know, I saw him become the superstar. But that leads me to you because you also came up in this moment, this mid to late aughts Atlanta renaissance moment. You came up alongside Yachty, alongside Harlow. Yeah. The center of the world, right, music and comedy was coming out of this place where you had grown up. Like, take me back to that sort of your glory days moment of rising amid all of these talents, whether it's the athletes, working with the musicians, working with the comedians. Like, you all came together to create something greater than the sum of your parts.
Atlanta has a big part of my success. And I say it because everybody in Atlanta sticks together. And some sorts, and we might not all be sticking together right now.
Sure.
But
yeah, I was going to say.
Not right now.
I was like, I don't know if
it's
that's
a gray area
true.
Right now it's a little.
Strictly speaking.
Right now it's a little everywhere.
It ebbs and it flows.
Nah, but it comes and it goes. And I think, but a lot of success comes from that and the support side of everybody supporting each other. Even if it's like you said, the athletes, the rappers, the singers in Atlanta, the OGs, the guys who are, or even the other comedians who also are doing skits or stand up or whatever. I think coming up
Icebox.
During that. Icebox. Like it's almost like the culture is there, but I remember being so inspired. I was in college and I was so inspired by seeing what the Migos did because I never saw anybody from where I was from in Atlanta.
You know, Gwinnett, that's where the real Migos at.
Yeah, that's where the Migos at anyway, in Gwinnett.
Seeing the Migos go to a new level and seeing them, they linked up with Drake and they went on this tour, an arena tour, and I was like, wow, this is, I had seen like other NBA players like Lou Will and like other dudes from athletic guys from Gwinnett blow up, of course, but I had never seen it on like the scale that the Migos had done. And I was like so inspired. And I remember just being like, damn, I want to be a Migo. Like I really wanted to just be like a part of their group.
Because you were
like
in high school?
Yeah,
like one band that was popping?
It was like my first year in college.
Yeah.
So I just remember everybody's reaction to the Migos early, like immediate fame and like how big it was blowing up. But like I said, I was inspired, and I think that had a lot to do with me wanting to pursue my own dreams, because I was like, all right, if I'm gonna do anything, I want to be number one in it, and I think I definitely want to achieve great things like how they've done. Because it's something about seeing it from close, somebody doing right, it close up, or like where you're from, or like. Or around you, you see it and you're like, wow, I'm more than just inspired seeing. Because you almost think it's unachievable when you see somebody from a far distance.
Right. It's abstract until it
comes home.
Yeah, it doesn't
feel like, like I could do it.
And
if
that's
it's not,
where in Atlanta, one guy leads to the next leads to the next guy.
Sure.
And also they use the same tools that you end up using, right?
Yeah,
Short-form virality, you know, clips on what it was. It was Vine before it was TikTok. Like, talk to me about who were like your content North Stars when you were that age, like a young person. Who were you following and seeing on social media, on YouTube and stuff, and being like, ah, I'm studying them, I'm watching what they're doing in music or comedy?
No, for sure. I think in comedy, I was constantly watching a bunch of like the OGs, like Bernie Mac and like Kevin Hart, and like watching interviews on Kevin Hart just speak intellectually, or and like just other side of like how he was viewing comedy and where he was at. But also on social media, I would watch a lot of the guys, and I think it was a weird time around that time when I first started, because a lot of the dudes were trying to go viral for wild shit. Like, I don't know if y'all remember the Boonk Gang era.
Boonk Gang, a lot of gang shit outside.
You're running the store.
Wow. Haven't heard that
shit
name
on the ground. Seriously. Nah, but that was like the era, like when I kind of started. I couldn't believe. Yeah, I couldn't believe what was going on. But I was like, damn, is this comedy? Like, I didn't even know what. I'm like, if this is how you blow up on the internet, I don't know if I could do this. Like, that's pretty wild. But at the time, that was the comedy world of social media at that time. That's what was going viral when I first started.
You know, it's true Vine era, which is just like truly like, how do you pack the most mayhem into
the tiniest
thing?
But that's what was going
right
in the comedy world. There was nothing really like funny from social media that was like blowing up, other than like you said, the 6 second binds and stuff. But I think it was a weird time when I first got in, because I was like, all right, I'm coming in with something way different. And I was still trying to find out who I was as a comic. And I just really didn't know. So, of course, years went by and it was a little, I was hit or miss. And I just continued to watch a lot of the OGs, because I was confused about what the social media world was doing with all the crazy running in gas stations and throwing shit and running out and stealing stuff. So I would just watch like Steve Harvey or Bernie.
So you were
Mac
trying
Kevin.
To bring an old school sensibility to these new mediums.
Yeah. And like even Eddie Murphy or Martin Lawrence, like I would watch all those guys and like see the characters they've done, or Dave Chappelle and like see what he did on his skit show. So yeah, I was trying to bring that back into like reality, because I knew we were in a crazy place on social media.
I wonder, like, knowing a little bit about your family, I think your mom worked at the CDC.
Yeah.
Your dad was in the Air Force.
Was a pilot, yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what was the entertainment profile in the house? Like, what were they raising you on, and what were they keeping you away from?
Yeah. No, my mom was, like, big on, like, all, like, the family black movies, like Johnson Planet Vacation, or, like, she would also occasionally show us, like, What About Bob? And I know y'all know about that. It's, like, a white cult classic right there.
What about Bob?
I don't know. Thank you for coming on a white show.
Yeah,
we appreciate
that. Yeah, no, but my mom was big on comedic movies that we were able to watch as like a family, and not just like the raw stuff. My dad was more like, he'll put on fucking Black Hawk Down and yell in your ear the whole movie and tell you like, yeah, you're gonna get your ass blown off if you don't get no job.
He's like, that part's real.
You find a trade, get a job, or you're gonna go to war and get your ass blown off. And he cut on Black Hawk Down on the TV, turn up the surround sound, shit like boom, boom. He's like, that's what the fuck's gonna happen. Like, my dad was really intense with all his lessons. So I think it was a good combination of both worlds. But that's pretty much what was happening in my house. And my dad watched a lot of Chappelle's show. My mom didn't really want us to watch that. And like South Park, he would cut on that stuff. And my mom would like tell me to go upstairs. But I still would like sit on the steps and try to listen to what Dave Chappelle's saying. So I would listen to the jokes and then go to school, repeat it. Like, I'm rich, bitch. All that stuff. Like,
and you've sort of made your career in that image where be it's on the crazy corporate side. I see that look on your face. Yeah, it's almost like you're getting away with something. Do you wake up and you're like, I cannot believe that
they let me do this? Nah, I think somebody came to me like they'll see some chaotic thing or something crazy on the internet. They'll be like, oh, then I just saw you on a T-Mobile commercial on TV. How the hell? I feel like I walk a line in comedy that is very, it appeals to all masses of the world. So it works, you know?
But is it walking a line or is it something different? Because I've been thinking
Somebody called me a jester.
It's a very O'Quran language. So I can get away with jester shit,
Do you feel you relate to that?
I don't know. I just read a tweet. It was like, he's a jester. And I was like, damn, am I a jester? Like, what the hell is a jester?
We're going to pull it like Theo Vaughn. We're going to pull the definition.
Like jesters, they put like the definition, the whole Grok language thing.
Get to make fun of the king to his face.
And they get away with everything. So,
my instinct is to view it that way. It's like he's walking a line. Yeah. But the more I think about it a little different, which is we are in an unusual moment of media right now where you could have been Records, could have been Love on YouTube, targeting the audience for that. Yep. And then you could have mainstream comedic appearances targeting an audience for that may or may not overlap with the YouTube audience. And then you're in ads on the Super Bowl, which has a totally different audience. Maybe they don't even know.
With the Backstreet Boys.
And they have no idea about could have been Love. It's actually less that you're walking a line and more that you're walking like three or four roads at the same time.
I like the way you broke that down.
This is what I do for my job.
Very, very well said.
But I wonder, do you ever fear that they are going to start bleeding into each other and therefore compromising your ability to do that?
Not really. I think Kevin Hart is like a good, great example of what even opened that door.
Mm-hmm.
Like seeing Kevin be in every single market. And I mean, every single market. The same. Also, I got to give credit to Eddie Murphy as well. Eddie Murphy was really good at it. Eddie Murphy was able to appeal to the kids, Dr. Dolittle, Shrek with Donkey. Mm. And then he's doing some of the most craziest movies. White face. He's doing all of that. Same with Kevin Hart. You'll see him be on all the commercials. And then you'll see him do the Mekhi and Kev stream where we're wilding out doing crazy, chaotic shit. So I think those two guys are the main ones that kind of open that door. If you can walk that line where it's like four or five different avenues of this different fan base. Cause even ladies come up to me on when we're riding in a Delta plane or whatever. And like, it's like a lady who's like 60 or 70 years old. She's like, Trisky, I love the stuff you do. You're so silly. I'm like, do you know all the shit I'll be doing?
Sure about that?
Are you sure that you know what the fuck I'll be doing? But it is dope to see like, that she may just watch some of the silly stuff I've done or not some of the chaotic. Maybe she just saw the church pastor video.
Right.
She didn't see all the could have been Love or could have been auditions, the kickouts. Yeah, the studs. So, you know, and I think you got to give credit to Kev and Eddie for that type of stuff. Because
does that loop back to what you were saying about your childhood and growing up, like that ability to code switch, to speak to different audiences. Sure. Is that something you had even before you thought of yourself as a performer? Sure.
Like my mom, she used to always jokingly say, we would go to the grocery store. She'd be like, oh, we're going out with the local celebrity. Going out with the local celebrity today. And my family had this joke because I was like popular on my football team. And like parents would always want to like come around and joke with me or like, because they knew I was a funny kid on the team with their kids. So I also would make them laugh by like acting like a grown up. And I'll act like I'm like, if I saw somebody smoking, I'm like, let me get a cigarette, man. Let me get one. Give me one of those. You know, I'll act like I'm a grown up with them. Like, hey, let me get one. And then like look away like I'm dead ass serious. So like the parents would want to like almost joke around and fuck around with me too. So it was a very funny way that my mom would be like, yo, why does all... Like the parents would be more excited, like, oh, there goes Drew right there. Yeah, what's up, Drew? Like my mom would be like, yo, that's
you had an audience before you had
like
an audience
before. Yeah. But I was able to also, like you said, code switch because my mom would send me to these camps. Like I went to a camp called Camp McCallie, and it was like an all white sports camp. And it really wasn't no, it might have been like one other black kid other than me, but it was like 500 of us. So I was able to have to try to find a way to blend it with these kids. Cause in Gwinnett, you have everything, but like I went to like a sports game. It was very fun, by the way, but it just was a whole different world. Like
were you popular at camp?
Yeah, I was popular at camp. So it was funny because, you know, the camp counselors there were like, yo, this dude's a nut, bro. Like, and like they sent notes back to my mom and like, we're loving him. And like, he's a funny kid. He just got to stay out of trouble. But I think, just being able to learn the different cultures and how stuff is, that helped me a lot navigate life later, you know. And learning songs like "Don't Stop Believing" by Journey, you know.
That's okay. Being around camps
oh man, all that white stuff. You just learn all that shit.
What else? What else was popping your camp?
Oh man, they
Dave Matthews
Band, Bonfires. You know what else? I could go on for years.
Go, it's, keep going.
What's another
Imagine
one?
Imagine the Clippets, Drewski's white classics.
They're big on the Beatles and shit. You know, like just weird stuff.
Bonfires and the Beatles.
Yeah, Bonfire Beatles.
Singing "Hey Jude" at the bonfire.
Yeah, stuff like that.
Not my white.
I guess it's very white for sure.
Do you think there's more comfort with racial funny now than there was 10 years ago? Like, I feel like I look at someone like Theo, who is willing to joke about stuff. Yeah, Theo's wild.
He goes all in.
And thanks, brother. We're not racist, or I'm not trying to be. You know, I have some flare ups in traffic, but overall, I'm good.
But like, I don't think you could have done that in the 2000s.
Yeah.
You could have done that in the 80s or 90s, but then it went away for a while. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's coming back now? Do you think that people have comfort
now? Back. It's back.
Yes.
Oh, it's back.
Why is it back? Why is it back?
I think it's back because I think a lot of people have lost like the feeling of like crazy shit happening. You know, like I feel like
outrage.
You see so, not even outrage, but like you see so much crazy stuff on social media
people
now.
You're numb to it. You're numb a little jaded.
You're numb to it. Like I just saw somebody get murdered on Twitter, and then you could go and just swipe, and the next video is like a funny video of maybe like a puppy or something.
Mm-hmm. So then you keep just swiping. The bar
yeah,
for
so
everything.
It's like we're so used to seeing like something chaotic constantly to where we're almost numb to whatever's going on. So I do think the racial jokes is back and they here for sure.
Mm-hmm.
They here. Like you said, Theo
from
Vaughn,
everybody.
Everybody. I think Theo Vaughn, Shane Gillis, they do a good job with it. They're very funny. And I think I think there's a way to do it without it being too far as well. I think I do it in a funny way as well.
And you think it could be the purview of any comic from any background?
Yeah. By purview, you mean?
Like that anyone could do. White comics can do it.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going a different route.
Oh, no. What's a purview? Tell me.
I don't know. Okay. That's what I wanted you to define.
Oh, okay.
No. You have to be a good comic to know what your voice is too. Like I think certain ones are good at it and certain ones is like it's too far. Some people
chill with that.
Some people some people can go too far. But yeah, most good comics, they know how to do it in a way that everybody can laugh.
So many of your characters have been playing with that line.
Oh, for sure.
Between the races, whether it's, you know, a black frat guy and a white frat.
Yeah. Or the Asian nail tech.
McKin, pass them off.
I do both now. Come.
Most women know about that guy too.
Yeah, that's real.
Oh, for sure. It's a real thing. He keeps them coming. He keeps them coming in.
And then now you have this NASCAR character.
Oh, man.
Who's blown up. Yeah. I feel like you hit a different level of crossing over audiences with even just the production values of those skits.
Yeah.
You know, I seen people interviewing your makeup artist who
Rolling Stone interviews.
made you white. Like,
Everyone needs content. Yo, she's very dope. Her name is Kaylee and she's like a diamond in the rough, bro. And like, she's so talented. Like even the one, like outside of my white face one, which she did amazing on, the one where I had the hair, the receded hairline joint, she did all that. Like, she's, like, so dope. And, I got to give her flowers, man, because she really does help with bringing these scenes to life, for real.
When you hit on a character like that, like, do you know that it can take you to another level? Like, you're already as big as it gets for a viral sketch comedian and corporate pitch man. But then you do something like that, widens the audience even further. Like, do you know that from the jump?
I think me and my team were like big fans of the art. So we like you know, the old SNL days where you see that it was like super chaotic with like Chris Farley or like Adam Sandler and all these guys were able to get their chops off, or like I know I mentioned it already, but like Eddie Murphy doing the white face on the bus where he's like, how does it feel to be a white man? Like all that stuff. Like we really want to bring that type of comedy back. And like, so I like to take it to the next level, even in the art side of it. Like we just shot a skit that hasn't come out yet. And like I was in there directing how the smoke and the gritty look in the air would help the skit look better than just the clear view of the shot from the camera. So yeah, it's been kind of getting to that point where we like to go all in. And the skits are getting a lot more expensive, by the way.
Well, I was going to say, from a production value point of view, I think there, you know, even as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, there was a sense of a false divide between social media content and like real television or real da-da-da. And now I think what's happened is real television is a lot more like social media, and social media production values have gone really way up.
Yeah.
So in your mind, you think you want to take the rawness of social media, like the sort of spontaneity and improvisational quality, but then add that production value to it and then upstream it to all the other places.
Yeah, I think I want to spend up to like $100,000 on the church skit and get all these people in here. I want to go in the air. I want to...
Only $100,000?
Yeah, no, it was up there, though. That's only $100,000.
I was going to say, that looks...
3 minutes, we ain't get paid for that.
But it looks expensive.
I ain't getting nothing back from that.
It looks expensive.
I ain't getting nothing back from that. Nah, it was around $100,000 to do the whole church skit. And I think it was well money spent. And even with a lot of the auditions, like people don't know the amount of cameras and the amount of angles and the amount of security and the building we have to rent out and the editors and all that stuff. It really takes a lot of money to shoot like that one day.
Yeah, talk to
us. What it looks like, people are like, oh, is it just a talent show? They're running in, running out.
That philosophy, though, where you take the money you make from your corporate
deals,
and you pour it back into making essentially YouTube and social media videos
for sure.
That you might not see any return on. Like, where does that come from as a businessman, that reinvesting, the importance of that for you?
For sure. I think it's very important, man, because I see so many people try to be like super flashy, or they try to spend their money on, you know, the cool stuff of like, oh yeah, I made some millions from this and I'm gonna go get a car, I'm gonna go get a house, I'm gonna go buy this. So like one of the biggest things I've ever done is that in the world of business is like reinvesting all our money from anything we do. If it's not a Nike commercial or the contract we got from Nike for doing stuff with them, or T-Mobile or Google or whatever it is, like you see me do Prize Picks, I always reinvest it into the show or into the skits. Or so that's very big for me, because I see the happiness it brings the fans. Like they can see that I actually care about it. I'm not just doing it. People are like, oh my God, I can't believe we're getting this show for free on YouTube. It's like, there's a reason you're getting this show like this. It's like, I'm reinvesting so you guys can enjoy
entertainment. Yeah, but talk to me about that, because I know there had to be streamer deals on the table. Like, why is something like Could Have Been Love on YouTube under your own name as opposed to on a Netflix or a Hulu or an Apple TV?
No, we tried. Like, trust me, we tried to go and do the stuff with them. And we actually have a show in the works right now with Netflix. Shout out to Netflix. I won't shit on them.
But, but all the other ones. Yeah,
nah, but I mean, of course, there's no's before the yeses. So for a while.
So it was no's for a while.
It was a lot of no's from everybody.
Even like once Amazon, you had the audience and you
were. Yeah, I had the audience. I could prove it. And I think we were in a weird space of like a lot of those streamer places had already tried with the guys in like 2018, 2017, 2018, 2019. I don't know if you remember, they started to do like, we're going to invest in creators. We're going to have creators do movies. And I'm not going to name no names, but you remember the era of like, oh, all these creators are doing,
trying to turn YouTubers social stars are doing, into
we're
like, they're
movie
stars.
We're going to turn them into movie stars. Mm-hmm. And it kind of all kind of like went to shit. Mm-hmm. And I felt like during that time, I was still coming up, so it didn't matter to me. But as I've progressed and got better, I see that a lot of those same companies have taken a big step back from like, oh, we don't trust that. Yeah, it didn't work. We're not really working with creators. We're not doing that. So it almost messed it up for me. I'm like, damn, no, I'm a real talent. I can do improv. I'm a great actor. I'm actually very funny. And we did all these pitches and they were like, yeah, we tried that. We understand creators. They've done it. And like, So is, you know, you get a bunch of no's before the yeses, and I think now is the time where we're finally getting those good yeses. And but I'm glad it happened that way. I'm not, you know.
Oh, we got bring it. Oh, yeah, sorry, coffee. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, gotta bring the coffee in. Sorry.
Thank you, Sophie.
No problem. Good. Keep going, guys.
You like that? That's our free. Yeah, that's our actually, free upstairs coffee.
Right, whole milk.
Yeah.
We took whole milk. Do you want us to get a fan going?
Keep that door open.
You're gonna order another. Give me another.
So I think one of the real flaws of that 2019-2020 moment with influencers getting all these big deals was there was this misunderstanding that the audience for someone doing, let's say, dances on TikTok was the same thing as an audience for a person making a movie on Netflix. It's not the same thing. So you have been almost forced by the nose to build an audience for television programming that looks more like conventional television programming. Yeah. That's going to be the thing that eventually gets you to success in those spaces, if I would guess.
Mm-hmm. That's why,
as
I said,
opposed to if you got it 3 or 5 years ago.
Yeah. That's why I said I wasn't mad at the nose. Looking back, you never really understand until you are in the future. You're like, damn, that's why it didn't work. I needed to work my way up to this level. Mm-hmm. And now I'm thankful. It's like, all right, I wasn't fully ready. Like, I thought I was like, I'm like, bro, I'm the shit. Like, I'm that guy.
Like, I can walk around All-Star Weekend and everyone knows me.
I wasn't there like I thought I was yet. And I'm thankful that I was able to, like, sharpen, you know, my tools to where it's like, all right, now I know this is the time, and it's not really when I thought it was, like 4 or 5 years back, mm-hmm. when I was getting the nose from all these companies and thinking like, oh, this show is amazing. This is amazing. Mm-hmm. Oh, this movie idea. Everything works out for the best.
This is A.G. Sulzberger. I'm the publisher of The New York Times. I oversee our news operations and our business. But I'm also a former reporter who has watched with a lot of alarm as our profession has shrunk and shrunk in recent years. Normally, in these ads, we talk about the importance of subscribing to The Times. I'm here today with a different message. I'm encouraging you to support any news organization that's dedicated to original reporting. If that's your local newspaper, terrific. Local newspapers in particular need your support. If that's another national newspaper, that's great too. And if it's The New York Times, we'll use that money to send reporters out to find the facts and context that you'll never get from AI. That's it. Not asking you to click on any link. Just subscribe to a real news organization with real journalists doing firsthand, fact-based reporting. And if you already do, thank you.
Obviously, you spent a lot of time with Kai Cenat, and you spent a lot of time around other live streamers. I wonder if you could talk about what you maybe have learned from the live streaming ecosystem, because when I look at Kai spending, I presume, $1 million on Mafiathons and things like that, these are people who are laying out insane amounts of money to earn back, hopefully, way more insane amounts of money. But that's something that I think that the biggest ones, whether it's, you know, Kai or Speed or even YouTube guys like Mr. Beast, like, they know that you have to spend money to make money.
Sure.
I wonder what you're learning from that generation of content creators who I think grew up differently maybe than you grew up.
Yeah. No, I think we were investing right before Kai started doing, like, Mafiathon. We were starting to show, like, I think the first show we did, we spent like $1 million. The second one, it's like 2.3. And the next one, like, we're getting to, like, Could Have Been Love and all this, like, mm-hmm. around the 3 million mark. And I'm like, damn, we're spending so much money. In my head, I think that's a lot. But, of course, TV companies, that's, like, nothing.
Yeah, it's rounding up.
Yeah, that's like, it's like whatever. But to come out of your own pocket and do it is insane. So, I see Kai do it as well. And, like, he's a big reinvestor in everything. Like, I see him, he may make 4 or 5 million and put 3.5 or 4 million back. Yeah. I think that definitely plays a big part. And it means a lot to see other people and not just me reinvesting in myself, but definitely Mr. Beast is another one. He's big on that. He claims he's broke, but I still think he's a billionaire. But he is reinvesting a lot, though. Sure. He's reinvesting a lot, yeah.
On your path to this mainstream legitimacy mm-hmm. that you're talking about, how important have the cosigns been along the way? Obviously, you're in 3 Drake music videos, but then you start popping up in the interludes of Justin Bieber's album. Yeah. You know, you have Timothy Chalamet coming on Could Have Been Records YouTube streams. Sure. Like, as the cosine snowball has grown, do you feel that opening more doors for you? Or sure. Is it just people who want to get on your ride?
Are they drafting off you, or are you able to draft off them?
I think it's 50-50. I think we both, in any realm, I think everybody has seen the good of having Drewski, and I've seen the good of having like Timothy Chalamet or like Mark Wahlberg do the show with me. Great creators understand that sometimes getting and inspired by somebody else's work can come in all different sizes or shapes, whatever. It doesn't matter. But yeah, I think doing that stuff has helped open other doors.
I have two specific questions about those recent crossovers from last year. Can you tell us how you ended up on Swag as the sort of voice of Justin Bieber's id?
You were pronunciating every word. You can't pronunciate every word when you're doing that. You guys are standing on business. You're standing on business.
Yeah, you're right.
I was going to say voice of reason, but it's actually the opposite.
Yeah.
It's the voice of lack of reason.
I've known him for a couple of years, and he always would hit me up and be like, bro, I love your shit. And like, we would just talk on FaceTime, just random calls about just like, we were both inspired by each other's stuff. But I knew we would do something, so I never really tried to force anything with him because I was like, I don't want to say, oh, let's do a skit. Or like, I'm not big on trying to force any type of thing that maybe the other person doesn't want to do. So, like 3-4 years went by, and then eventually he called me. He was like, yo, are you still out here in L.A.? I saw you were out here. And I was like, damn, I'm getting right to the airport. Like, we had just pulled up in front of the Delta thing. And he was just like, yo, just if you could cancel that flight and come to the studio right now. And I was like, for what? And he's like, yo, I want you on this album and we're turning it in tomorrow. And I'm like, damn, there's no excuse I could come up with. Of course, I would never give an excuse to him, but like, I had to do that because I'm like, bro, I love Justin Bieber forever. Like, there's no way I can't do this. So we turned around immediately. Like, we didn't even think twice.
You're like, cancel everything.
Yeah, we canceled everything and went straight to the studio. And like, he was in there. And I think that day, I was feeling funny because I knew everybody was going to be smoking weed in the studio. He has friends in there. Some of my friends smoke weed. So I told my friends, I was like, yo, let's stop at the gas station. I want to, because I hate being around people. If they're doing something, I want to do it too, but I don't smoke weed or do drugs. So I was like, hey, give me a Black and Mild from out of there. So we went and got a bunch of Black and Milds.
You brought ceremonial Black and Wilds.
Because I hate when people are smoking. I want to, you know, when you just want to hit the blunt, but you don't, I don't smoke. So I'm like, I want to be smoking. So I want to look cool with y'all.
Relatable.
So I brought a Black and Mild and they were laughing at that. It was like, bro, what the fuck are you smoking a Black and Mild with us in the studio? Like, bro, this is not good for our singing voice. Like, so he was already laughing at that. And I was like, yo, we should just record a combo of us. Like, I think we don't force nothing of what it could be. I think, and me and him talked already about like, he wanted to get off like some of the stuff he had been going through in the media and all the, him yelling at the paparazzi. Mm-hmm. So he was like, yo, this would be a good moment to get that off in like a funny way to where it's not serious. He didn't want to get too serious. He wanted to have an interludes that were talking about that stuff without it being serious.
Right, to let the music
breathe.
I was like,
yo, just let me do like a therapist session. I'm going to smoke this Black and Mild. Y'all do what y'all do. And we just going to talk. And they broke it into like 3 different ways. And that, it was.
How long
was
did you record for? You just did like a
We had a whole, it was like an hour long conversation.
Oh, so it was.
So they
crazy.
Just broke up the piece.
We need the uncut.
Stuff y'all heard, I didn't even know they were going to use the coughs. And say, hey, I've been coughing and all that.
That's it was the Black and Mild.
Yeah, it was literally like an hour conversation. And then they took 3 pieces of that and made it like all like.
Bonus footage.
I still wish he would have won that Grammy for best album. That album was really good.
Really, really good really album. Good, we're big Swag fans.
All right, so my other Drewski and Swaggy White Boy question is Timmy singing Kirk Franklin.
Oh, yeah. Something about the name Jesus.
What you know about that, boy? Something about the name Jesus.
It is the sweetest name.
Scripted or unscripted?
The whole thing with me and Timmy was unscripted.
Did you know that he could get on that level?
He surprised you with that for real?
Yeah, he surprised me. I saw some pictures of him like dressed as Soulja Boy back in the day.
Right. Yeah.
So I knew all bad. I'm like, okay, he a wigger. All bad. I knew. But I couldn't.
You could smell it.
I just knew from doing my research. I'm like, okay, he a wigger. But I didn't know. Like, when you meet certain people,
Kirk Franklin's
a
different level.
Yeah, Kirk Franklin was a whole new level. Yeah. That's like back like with my family. That's like church stuff. So when he did that, I was like, yo, what you know about that boy? Like, what you know about that? And like, we just had a funny moment. But I think
it's an incredible moment.
And I think me and him, we've talked since then multiple times about like possibly doing something together, like a Bad Boys type film or like something like a Rush Hour. And it's just an idea right now. But
oh my God, Drewski, yeah, we'll see buddy cop.
We'll see. He's into it. We'll see what happens. I haven't seen him do any like crazy comedy.
Yeah, comedy. Really.
There was comedy in Marty Supreme.
Yes. Yeah.
He's a funny guy.
Yeah, he's a funny guy. But I think seeing the both of us, I think a lot of people really loved to see the chemistry that we shared on camera. So yeah, me and him definitely had a couple conversations about what could be, you know? So yeah.
I wonder, sorry, it's the Kirk Franklin thing is just... It's absolutely out of control.
Yeah, I couldn't.
I like how y'all lost it when I said wigga.
Oh my God.
You said it. Too close to the real world.
A lot of people have a lot of ideas about Timothy Chalamet and his cultural affinities.
Yeah.
But you boiled it down.
It's the truth. It's the truth, man.
I wonder, okay, so you had your own tour recently, but you also have been on tour with various rappers over the years.
Yeah.
I really want to know what's the difference between a comedy tour and a rap tour.
Very different. There's way more girls backstage at a rap or maybe that was because I went on tour with Chris Brown.
That's a whole other thing.
I was like, yo, he nuts. But that's the big difference between that and comedy
tour.
You don't have to get one after a comedy tour. You're lucky to get one. Yeah, no. It's not. They're not lining up like that. Let's just say that. Yeah.
Talk to me about this last step into Hollywood, right? You had your couple little cameos. You haven't had a meaty film or television role. Yeah. Is that something that you still want?
Yeah, that's why we're having, you know, meetings with like Josh Safdie or, you know, a lot of these execs. Because I've had opportunities to appear in certain movies, but it never really was like, I'm very particular about putting the right step forward and not scary at all, but like I don't like to do just everything. So we've had some stuff that we like turned our back on as well because we wanted the first one to be a big outbreak. We wanted like the Adam Sandler, Happy Madison type outbreak. You want the Will Ferrell type outbreak. So you kind of we've tried to make the smart decision of waiting, and it's paid off. It's been really good, and I think now is the time that people will see, like, you know, the international superstar, international fame of movie star type stuff.
You say you don't want to do everything, but you're everywhere.
Yeah, no.
Is there such a thing as overexposure for Drewski?
Oh, for sure. Like, after this year, I don't even know if I'll be at a Super Bowl or an All-Star game. Everywhere. Oh, my God. Yo. Nah, but I think there is a different way you have to go about overexposure and definitely, like, play your cards right and, like, sometimes you just got to go ghost. And it's hard to do when you're working on so many things. But like me and my team, we were talking about that more recently. You do have to sometimes take a step back. But it's also good to be around still in some type of way. You don't have to do everything all at once. But it definitely taking a step back. And
is it hard to say no?
Nah, it's not hard to say no. It's just when you're so... I just be wanting to achieve so much that it's like hard to like stop. You know what I mean?
I saw something that you said, maybe it was to the Breakfast Club or one of the other interview you'd done where you talked about accidentally seeing Jim Carrey's paperwork for maybe a Dunkin' commercial.
I actually got in trouble for saying that.
Okay. Well, apologies. But
Jim Carrey is in a Dunkin' commercial?
He didn't show up for a lot of money. He was supposed to be
in that commercial and we accidentally saw how much that Dunkin' was supposed to pay him just to appear and do it for a 2-hour shoot.
Okay.
Insane.
And so I wonder, seeing that and knowing the gap between where you are, even now, that was a year or two ago, like knowing that gap is achievable, that someone can get whatever that number is.
For an hour of their time.
Right. Does that make it really hard to say no? Because you think that number or something like it is on the back of the yes, which is on the back of the next yes, which is on the back of the next yes.
There's a lot of stuff we've said no to. And I think even looking at his career, you could tell he's not doing everything. You haven't really seen Jim Carrey do anything that's not
Which is
like,
why
amazing,
he can command that
which
price.
Which is why he can command that price.
Interesting.
So it is a coaching type situation. Seeing that, I'm like, oh, okay, if there's a way he went about doing this. And even if he said no to that, it's like, what do you really want?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you want right. to do it?
And, know, and maybe so, it's not monetary.
Yeah, maybe it's not monetary. I think he's
could have been records.
Yeah, he's
could have been records audition. Put it in the world.
He's great though. He's great though, man. And I'm a big fan of Jim Carrey as well. Like I used to study all his stuff, like Fire Marshal Bill, and you know, from seeing that turn to The Mask or The Grinch, like
or In Living Color,
yeah,
like
In Living
way
Color,
back in
that
the
whole yeah. everything he did on Living Color just showed like around all the black comics and how great they were during that time. To see him shine, like he was really shining around amongst some real, really, really talented like stars.
English
yeah, they were
real.
They were big. So. I think that if anything is talking about taking a step back at some point and, you know,
make yourself scarce so then you can get that Jim Carrey money.
People miss you. You know, you shouldn't always be in the spotlight. So, yeah, that's something I definitely am working on for sure. Yeah.
Do you feel like when you have your true Hollywood breakthrough, like like when there's like Drewski above the title, is that likely to be one of the characters we already know blown out to a full script, or is it going to be a different kind of film?
There is one right now that's in the works that people have seen.
Okay.
And I think people would probably guess on what that is.
Sure.
But yeah, no, there's probably one or two. There's about two that.
So you think there's Drewski character stuff and there's Drewski in big Hollywood stuff, and those things
for sure.
can coexist.
And I think both of those can coexist. And I think, but yeah, they are both being worked on currently. I don't want to say too much.
But do we at some point are we going to come back 5 years from now and you're going to be sitting here as Drew Debord?
I like how you pronounce it. Actually,
yeah, you got a little extra French.
It's Debord. Debord. That's a French last name.
But are we going to get that?
This guy's a nut, bro.
I see what I have to deal with every day?
Every day.
Yeah, most people call it Desbord as
not
a
Debord.
Yeah, no, that's Debord.
Debord. So, but are you going to come back and say, actually, so here's my new romantic comedy. Here's my rom-com. You know, it's like the character stuff was great, I did that so that I could do this. In your mind, is that?
I always hated seeing my favorite comedians go serious. So I wouldn't say
you're not an eternal sunshine guy.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be the one I'm trying to go get that Academy Award.
Punch Drunk Love?
And
no?
be crying and all.
You don't like Punch Drunk Love?
The only thing I would say I loved from a comedian standpoint is the way Jamie Foxx has done his career with doing like a biopic or something
Ray.
Or, you know, like seeing sometimes the seriousness of that. I think definitely, or Django. It's really good. They did
Eddie Murphy and Dreamgirls.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
That was a really good one as well. So, yeah, and seeing Eddie be serious in some of the stuff he's done, it's like I would do like a both, but like that would be the only way I would do it. I think I never like when you see your favorite people go super serious. You'd be like, ah.
You don't think it's just a side effect of the aging?
Yeah, just put a bad taste in your mouth.
Yeah, you reach a certain age, you get some gray in the beard, man. Then you got to do something with a little gravitas.
Yeah, but some people get funnier as they get older. Like, you don't remember
Fox.
Pops? Yeah, like fucking, what was John Witherspoon?
John Witherspoon.
Like, man, insane, bro. And he'll just be eating like some pork chops and he'll have you laughing, bro.
I grab a dog and I choke him and I kick the shit out of him. And I all day long, I foot up a dog's ass. Just bang, bang, bang up his ass. That's my pleasure.
Oh my God. Nah, John Witherspoon is one of the, man, nah. Y'all don't know. I can tell y'all don't know about what I'm talking about.
I know. We know John Witherspoon. Come on.
Bam. You know John Witherspoon?
Come on, man. I'm 50 years old.
I just don't know. I don't know.
It's a safe space to talk about John
Witherspoon. No. He's goated.
Safe space to talk about John Witherspoon.
Yeah, he's goated.
You've had such a quite charmed rise from the outside over the last couple of years, just like stratospheric.
For sure.
But that's also come with getting caught up in people thinking they have ideas about your real life.
Yeah.
Last year, you were wrongfully accused in a lawsuit tied into the Sean Combs stuff with an account that was found to be totally baseless.
Oh, bullshit, yeah.
It was, you know, from before you were famous. They said you were in a room with all these other people doing the worst things imaginable.
Yeah.
I mean, like, did that burst a bubble for you to think like, oh, there's things that come with this fame
that isn't what I signed up for.
No, I knew that like people could lie and like have stuff that was like completely, and by the way, it's completely was bullshit
and was thrown out.
And it never was a thing. But it is, I knew that like seeing like the people I looked up to, like Will Smith and like, you know, you see like Tyler Perry, like these guys I really looked up to. And before I was even famous, I would see this stuff about them. So you never know what's really going on. But I think, thank God that like it was thrown out and like it, people knew it was never a thing. But like I knew I, when getting famous, I'm like, yeah, there's going to be some shit that happens or like that people just throw out there.
But knowing it and actually going through with it are different. Did it weigh on you during the time?
Yeah, it weighed on me because you almost feel betrayed by your fans. Like, damn, y'all really, you see how crazy this shit sounds? Like, this is fake. And it almost sounds, the way they wrote it up is like comedic. So you can't even believe that people are believing it.
If you read the file itself,
yeah,
right?
I'm like, yo,
but then it becomes a headline that becomes an Instagram post like, that becomes
but that's
a...
what I feel like we live in weird times right now, too, that like real media is getting mixed up with like AI stuff, too, mm-hmm. or like bots on Twitter. So I'll read like a tweet about like from that situation and it'll be like that same tweet 50 times from different accounts. It'll be like, yo, what the? And you're swiping through, you're like, oh, so this is like a mass... Like, I don't even know where this is coming from. Like, some of this is like a robotic
AI campaign.
Yeah, so you see some of that stuff, and then you see it on other people, too, where it just piles on. And it's like, you go to the page, it's like a fake page. Like, all of them is like zero followers, but they got like 100 retweets. Like, how the hell do you already have 100 retweets? You ain't got no followers.
What's some of the other craziest stuff? Because I see stuff about you. Oh, it's a CIA psyop. Oh, he's working with foreign governments. Sometimes it's a joke, but sometimes it's not. Like,
No.
You
I agree.
See stuff out there.
You see stuff out there.
How do you know what to respond to, what not to respond to?
I knew that situation. We just had to shut down immediately because it was like, I saw people actually believe. At first, we laughed at it and I was like, yo, people, this internet, this AI stuff is crazy. And then I started seeing like real fans believe me. I was like, all right, we got to shut it down and like really get behind this. But I think, yeah, there's all type of stuff. There's, man, you see it all the time in other celebrities that it's like a, it's like almost you can't tell the difference between the real and what's not currently. On a social media level, it is taking a turn with the AI, the bots and all that stuff. So it's a little bit more heightened than just regular media on the TV of like something happening, you know?
Do you feel the same about critiques of your work? Like there was a comedian, Jay Jordan, who said that, you know, I struggle with Drewski, who's funny, but I feel like he punches down.
You can like the sketches where he's in a TSA shirt that's too tight. You can like the Amazon warehouse sketches. I don't like taking advantage of poor people.
He said you don't punch down, but I feel he takes advantage of poor people, puts them in these situations. Yeah. Like, I wonder when you see something like that, you're clearly like a thoughtful and reflective guy. How do you engage with what is fundamentally a thoughtful and reflective critique of your work?
I think, man, you got to just believe that what you're doing is right. And the reason why you've even done it in general is for the same reason you started. Like looking back and like when I first started, like I had controversy for some of the smallest skits. And I thought, and people didn't even know my name. They were just like, this fat motherfucker, he's talking about Mexicans and da-da-da-da. He doesn't understand. I'm like, yo, what the hell? Like, how the fuck? And then you just see it just go away. But for like 3 days,
it's
everywhere. And I think even as I've grown, I started to see like with some of the amazing jokes that I have and like some of the skits that are really very well received, the biggest controversy comes from it. It's like the pastors or the white face even made it to the news, man. And I'm like, damn, how the fuck did this make it on Fox News, bro? So I've learned to deal with it and understand that if it's great, it's going to come with the good and the bad, and you just keep it pushing. But yeah,
you trust your intentions.
Oh, for sure.
You don't think that you're taking advantage of folks.
No, not at all. I think with anything I do, I definitely know the place I come from. I understand everything that I'm doing, everything. And me and my team, we really pride ourselves on doing business the right way, which is why you never heard anything crazy. It's like, yo, we really are doing right by everybody, and we've never done anything with bad intent, you know? It comes with the good. That's why I'm not mad at the controversy behind skits or anything.
That just means they're reaching new audiences.
Yeah, it's like it's reaching new audiences. And it's just, it comes with being more famous for whatever it is.
But also to me, like there was a preacher, I don't know the name of the gentleman, but who posted a couple of videos about your preacher skit. Yeah. And some people had said that it reminded them of him. Yeah. And I was struck most by, it's like, if raise your hand if you think it's about you, then you make a video about, if he makes a video, I'm just like, well, you're kind of...
Hit dog, you, gonna holler.
Right, that's hit dog's gonna holler. It's like, you're telling us, you're telling us something. Yeah. And I feel like...
By the way, those videos are hilarious of the pastor trying to explain.
Yeah, right.
Like, it is hilarious.
But that just makes you feel like you hit a nerve.
You hit a nerve. You did it right. That's what I was getting to. Which is just like, you that to me, that says that anthropologically... You did something that was so close to the truth.
For sure. And which is why it always hits, man, because it is very close to the truth. And in the past 2 years, I've noticed the controversy has risen above everything. Mm-hmm. Now, whenever we drop something, it's like, damn, like, even when I did Whiteface, it was like a redneck dude that made a video.
Well, I put my finger on it. I've seen that guy before.
He said, you kind of look like me, man. And he said, I understand. He said, man, what you said there was funny, man. I feel just like you in that skit. So it's like, it does always reach a good audience that understands. And then, of course, it's going to reach the media that is going to try to tear everything down.
Yeah, you're a habitual line stepper. It's your job.
Yeah, same with Martin Lawrence. Like, they used to put his stuff in newspapers or on the news or like... I used to think it's so funny looking back, like even just talking about controversy and all that type of stuff. Looking back, like I used to, I remember seeing Tiger Woods when I was a kid on TV. I thought he murdered somebody.
Right.
Yo, I didn't know Tiger Woods just cheated on his wife, which is, by the way, it's a bad thing.
Don't do it.
But I had no idea.
Because of the way that they were treating him.
Bro, he was on CNN for like weeks.
Yeah. Obviously, you've been in Drake videos. I know a little bit of the story of the one in Oregon.
What are you doing?
What?
But, like, I want to talk about the Churchill Downs video.
Everybody's acting irreplaceable. It's like they ain't disposable. My urges for revenge are uncontrollable. I know.
Can we talk a little bit about, like, the styling for that? Can we talk about Jack and his family? Can we talk?
Yeah. He's like, I want to get into all
Let's get active.
Nah.
Yeah, talk to me about a very special day in Kentucky.
Yeah, that was an amazing time, man. And it was such a cultural moment for, like, all three of us even being there. But more so Jack, you know, that's his hometown. And like there's probably the most people that's ever been to Churchill Downs ever for like
bigger
like
than the important. Horse race.
Bigger than the horse race itself. Like we were in like a suite in the middle of the field and like people were wrapped around the entire thing. Mm-hmm. And like we stepped out on the balcony and like everybody's chanting our names and like screaming and they're shooting the music video. So it was a huge moment for him. And just to see that Drake coming to his hometown and being a part of that song was like a huge moment just in general as well. Cause you know, at the time, like everybody was like, you know, he's like, oh, he's the white boy. He's the one right now. He's doing it. And like to see him come and like embrace him like that and like and be a part of that. It was a big
dress for
deal.
The part. Local
oh, for
culture.
Sure. Yeah. Even me. Like,
yeah,
I had
that's what
on
I'm saying. Tell
a
me
bunch
about
of cowboy stuff and like, yeah, I don't even know. I threw on some bullshit that day.
But, you styled yourself?
I styled myself.
Highly. But, you weren't styled. They didn't.
I thought it was
a coordinated
look. I think everybody at the Kentucky Derby just were all wearing cowboy shit. So I brought like a cowboy hat and like a cowboy shirt. And I think we just did it. You know, it was random. But it was a great moment. I think that was a big time.
No Birkenstocks that day.
Nah, no Birkenstocks that day. No. Everybody had cowboy boots on and shit.
How many pairs of Birkenstocks you own? Just out of curiosity.
Probably past 100, man.
100? Wow. In active rotation?
I actually just got gifted some chrome heart.
With the chrome buckles.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you didn't have those already.
No. I just...
You like the originals.
One of my boys, Hunter, from my team, gifted them to me. So that was a dope gift.
But that's 100 in active rotation or 100 over the course of the last five years?
Over the course, I've thrown some away. You know, it's...
How do you know when it's time to go?
Oh, you know. Yeah, you can smell when it's time to go out that Birkenstock.
You got the Rick Owens Birkenstocks?
You know.
You got the
no, I don't have those.
Oh, we got to get those.
That's the real thing?
Yeah. Corpone here.
Damn.
Yeah.
No, I never heard of that
one. Yeah, no, you got it. That's what I got at the house.
That's good. Plug me in with that. Yeah.
We got to hit a couple questions in the podcast lightning round, then we'll eat a snack. We got a deck of cards. Each card corresponds to a pre-written question. Okay. So why don't you pull a couple, start with one, and we'll go from there. You tell us what you pulled.
Four of hearts.
What is a song that you associate with love? First of all, have you been in love?
I don't feel like I've been in love yet.
At 31, not yet.
Nah, not yet, man. I've had indulgements. I'll say that.
That's not love.
That's not love. But no, I've had a feeling of what I thought was love, and then looking back, it wasn't. So I thought at one point it was, yeah. But to answer the question, yeah. Probably something by Young and May, man. You know, big on the studs. Big on the studs, man. Something by Young and May, you know.
You call her Stephanie, uh-huh. I call her Heffany.
Look, if you don't think Ooh is a love song, you're not from New York.
Yeah, for real.
You're not from New York. Yeah. Also, Atlanta, yeah. It speaks to Atlanta, but it's surreal. That's a New York love song.
It's a real thing, man. It's a real
New York love song.
That's amazing. All right, pull another card.
Two of Diamonds. Oh, this is when it gets
okay,
crazy.
This is a tough one. What is the hardest thing that's happened to you in your personal life that your career prevented you from dealing with properly?
God damn.
I know, right?
Now, I've missed a funeral that I wish I wouldn't have, but it was because of like traveling work. But I paid for the funeral. It was a friend I grew up with, childhood friend. Mm-hmm. And it was a sad moment. But I remember on the day of, I was kind of like very sad. Like I felt it.
Yeah.
And that was the first time. I was like, damn, I usually won't feel like that type of sadness unless you go to the funeral.
And you were on set somewhere? Or?
But yeah, I think it was some commercial shoot or we had audition. But I paid the whole family's funeral expense, everything. So I felt good about it, but I did feel like some type of, like, damn, I could have been
in
there.
Did it make you think differently about your priority set?
Mm.
Like, if God forbid, obviously we don't wish ill on any of your friends, but God forbid that happens again, do you think you'll handle it differently?
I think I definitely would pay for another funeral for sure, but I think I would probably show up depending on how close I am with the person for sure. Yeah, yeah. Even though I hate funerals, I definitely would try to prioritize that for sure. Yeah.
All right, pull one more card.
Yeah, this is getting dark, man. What the hell are y'all doing?
Hopefully it'll be a light one.
Yeah, what the fuck?
Intimate is, I think, the word you're looking for.
All right, seven of clover, or what is it?
Seven of clubs.
Seven of clubs, yeah.
Not a gambler.
All right, all right, you're back in the light. Tell me about your first car.
Okay. First car, man.
It did have a name.
It got repossessed. No, it did not have a name.
Okay. Did it really get repossessed?
Yes. Yeah, the name is
It
goodbye.
Got repossessed.
What was it?
It was a Chrysler 200C. So it was kind of like one, like the new type vibe.
The fake
like,
Cadillac Chrysler. Like
no, not that one.
Like a big body?
No. It wasn't the one that looks like a, I see him shaking his head. He know what I'm talking about. It's like a 200C, but it was nice on the inside. It had like a cool dash. But it got repossessed, man. It was like the first year I had started doing skits. I had quit my job. And I told my mom I was going all in on everything I was doing. I was like, I'm taking a chance with it. I'm not going to work a job. I'm not going to do no illegal stuff. I don't care if I go broke. I'm going to just go all in.
Yeah.
And I remember the day it got repossessed.
You went broke.
Yeah, no, I didn't have enough money to pay it. Like, I knew I was going to have to figure something out. But, like, I didn't have enough followers to do no promo stuff either, like no story promo. So I was in a weird place and I couldn't pay it. It was only like 300 something a month. It was like 375 a month. I couldn't pay it, man. And I remember the day they came and I recorded it. I put it on my page and I was like, well, there she goes. And it was over with. And I think from there, like I used that as motivation. That's why I posted it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of like the followers during that time saw it and was like, wow, this is crazy that you actually... You admitted to like that you got repossessed,
and that was
like,
your first viral video.
No, it wasn't viral at all. It only got like 40 comments, but I think it just was used as motivation. Like I was like, all right, I'm going all in, and I'm gonna show everything that happens as the journey goes on. So
every episode of Popcast ends with a snack.
Okay,
you walked over to our pantry.
Yes.
You know, you didn't really look around.
I'm going to be honest. I expected
that you just went with your gut.
There's a lot of stuff over there that's from overseas, though. Yeah, there's a lot of weird shit. I thought it was edible stuff. No, I thought it was weed edibles. It looked weird.
You picked the most weed edible looking thing.
Yeah, nothing looked more like a weed edible than these Amos brand 4D fruit gummies.
You got to show ID to buy these.
Where is this from? Is China?
It's from Hong Kong. It is expired, but it's okay. It's a gummy, so they'll last a nuclear holocaust. Yeah, yeah, you know, like
you want to pick a different one?
No, that's fine.
It's lightly expired. It's lightly expired.
I trust y'all.
First of all,
hey, give me the gamble.
Expiration dates are a theoretical.
Everybody gonna take one with me.
It's a theoretical concept.
Everybody's taking one.
Yeah, of course. We're all going down.
Everybody take the shit.
We eat it. We rank it out of 10.
Okay,
but be thorough about your experience.
Don't put that one back. Put your hand on.
They're strawberry 4D. So the four dimensions, I just want to say, the four dimensions are 3D plus delicious.
What y'all not
delicious.
About to do is break it down like this shit is science, bro.
It is science.
It's a regular gummy.
There's food scientists.
What?
Entire job
is that,
doing
this. Is that a regular gummy?
No, you're right. This is kind of weird.
Oh, this is gelatinous. Cheers. This is extremely gelatinous.
It's a 4D strawberry gummy
y'all know,
from
y'all
Hong
know this
Kong.
This is pork. I don't know if y'all know that.
Sometimes.
Gummies is pork.
Sometimes. Not always.
Think so? Not always.
Oh, should I look on the ingredient list to see if it says pork
right here?
You taste the pork.
No, you can taste it. This is good, though. It don't taste expired.
No, it tastes fresh. It tastes like a strawberry.
You want another one?
No, I'm good.
Don't taste
that good. Another one, but yeah, it's good.
I'm going to be honest.
Something off.
I don't mind the flavor.
Something off about it.
Something
off.
I don't mind the flavor, but it's just it's so laborious.
Yeah.
It's a heavy chew.
What does that word mean? Laborious?
Like, it takes a lot of work. To chew.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like your jaw really going.
Yeah, laborious?
You're setting me up.
Who the fuck uses the word laborious, bro?
Welcome to
podcast. You need to smoke some weed, man. I told
you.
You
need to loosen up,
you gotta
right?
smoke some Welcome weed, podcast. Bro. Loosen up.
Dog, we doing this
laborious?
Every... First of all, we doing
why
this.
Why
every...
is just not chewy?
First chewy would have done.
Anyone can say chewy.
Oh, you're right.
No, but we've been talking about doing a thing where every time John says an SAT word, we got to pop up the Merriam-Webster definition laborious. Like on the screen. We're going to work
the fact
on that.
That y'all
Did any of y'all in here know what the fuck laborious meant?
Don't leave me hanging.
Exactly.
Here's the thing. Can I be honest?
Fuck you did it, man. You did not know what laborious
Can I be honest with y'all?
What?
The fact that y'all think these are SAT words is troubling to
Bro,
me.
Bro, laborious?
It's troubling to me.
Who the fuck is saying laborious in everyday life? I've never heard it.
Don't let me catch.
Never in my life.
Here's the thing. Could have been love. Season three.
Listen.
I need to see that on season three.
Listen,
I need to
I
see
gotta
it.
Look this up on an encyclopedia or something.
We're gonna send you home right. with a word list.
With a dictionary.
Well, I gotta go to Telemundo right now. So.
Yeah, they asked
that's
them.
A whole other word might, list we gotta learn.
Los Laborios.
Oh, for sure.
That is our show. Drewski, yes. What a joy.
Yes, thank y'all,
a
man.
A pleasure.
Great
really
questions,
happy
by the way. You guys are very in tune.
I appreciate
very, very in tune.
We do our best.
Yes, and y'all are great at what you do. That was
that's
probably,
really
probably top three interviews I've ever done.
Who are the other two? Because we're gonna come.
Well,
for
no,
them.
We don't got to talk about it. But I'm just saying, top three.
Would they
just
know y'all
on the top three.
Just whoever they are, we know they're coming
one,
from.
One, two,
them.
Three. Yeah, y'all on the top.
Not two.
Yeah,
top two. The other thing I was going to say is I know you studied a little bit of broadcast journalism when you were still in school.
Yes, yes.
Is there anything that you want to switch chairs and ask us?
No, I want to get out of here. I want to go
okay,
tell
fine. Yeah, no. That is our show. Every episode of Popcast is at nytimes.com/popcast. We are on YouTube at youtube.com/popcast. Instagram, TikTok, get a gummy. It's a laborious life, but someone's got to live it. We'll see you next week.